today your oral submissions on the bill, and on the 14th of June 2023, the department will return to the committee chair to provide the responses on the bill. So my role for this morning, Chair, is to take the committee through written submissions that were received for the persons who are not going to be doing oral submissions before the committee today. And then the department's role at the 14th of June will be to respond to those submissions. Just a brief reminder of the objects of the bill, Chairperson and members. It's to amend the National Road Traffic Act to provide for the suspension and cancellation of the registration of an examiner for driver's licenses or an examiner of vehicles if such person has been convicted of an offence listed in the Criminal Procedures Act, specifically Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. To provide for the registration and grading of training centres, to provide for the registration of manufacturers, builders, bodybuilders, importers and manufacturers of number plates, including manufacturers of reflective sheeting for number plates, embossers of number plates, weighbridge facilities, manufacturers of microdots and suppliers of microdots and microdot fitment centers. It also extends the right to appeal to the above listed entities and bodies. The further objectives are to require the provincial department responsible for land, for transport or local authority to register driving license testing centres. It provides for the appointment of inspectors of manufacturers and those listed entities. It prohibits the use of unauthorised aid during a test for learner's license or driving license test and the disqualification thereof. It provides for the registration and grading of driving school instructors and driving schools. And it also regulates further on international driving permits and foreign driving license and permits and matters incidental thereto. So inputs were received, Chairperson, from the and committee members from general public via email, the Amajube Driving School Association in Newcastle, KZN, the Western Cape Department of Mobility, the South African Local Government Association, the South African Driving School Operators Association, the Medical Research Council and the Congress of South African Trade Unions, Chair. The last two presenters are here with the committee today to do their oral submissions. So if you're looking at the, this is only the email submissions, Honourable Committee. On the question, do you support the bill? Yes, was 66% of persons, that's about 38 of the 660 email submissions said yes. 18%, that's about 118 submissions said we partially support the bill. And 76%, that's 504 of the email submissions said no, we object to the bill, Chair. A lot of the objections are related to clause 40 of the bill, which we will deal with going a bit lower, Chair. And Chair, with the email submissions, a lot of the submissions would say I object to the bill, but not necessarily to the detail that one is able to discern what the actual root cause of the objections are, Chairperson. But nonetheless, those written submissions will still be, those email submissions, Chair, is also part of the submissions that the department will come and respond to on the 14th. So if you look at the breakdown of the comments on the clauses, like I said, a lot of the objections was related to clause 40, which is the which is essentially the limitation of liability of persons responding to disaster management incidences, but I'll deal with that just a bit lower down. 42% of the inputs related to the objects of the bill, which is an option people use when they want to, as it says, object to the broader objects and not a specific clause necessarily. So if I go into a bit of a detail about the actual submissions received, there was some support from the bill, especially the view that the bill will address a number of loopholes. Number, the first one being that it will introduce accountability on how driving schools operate, and the sense that there's really been predators operating within the sector in the absence of such accountability that have cheated the public. And in one person's words, actually forced the public into buying driving license. Other reasons for supporting the bill is that it will reduce crime and contribute to addressing job scarcity in the country, as the view is that it will create more business opportunities for persons to take part of. And then in general, if it's to bring about more accountability and less corruption should be supported. That's the views for supporting the bill, Chairperson. When you go to the various clauses, Chair, that that most people commented on, an earlier version of the bill, that was B720, when it was introduced, Chair, prohibited the concentration of alcohol in the specimen of blood or specimen of breath taken from any driver in order to enhance road safety. The version of the bill that is before us now, Chairperson, no longer contains that prohibition. So we have received submissions from people, Chair, who are petitioning the committee to, even if it's not to return to a 0% concentration, to consider a reduction in the blood alcohol level that is permissible. So both Basata, for example, and Prof. Perry, who's with us today, are going to be touching on that in their submissions. There's a concern that when institutions such as the Road Traffic Management Act is subject to provisions from a number of legislation, that this can create confusion. There's also a sense that if the existing legislation is properly enforced, corruption will be eradicated and the new bill would not be necessary. In the respect of the registration of officers, Chairperson, registration and grading of officers, there's a view, Chair, that the category of spouse or partner is not the only relationship through which a financial interest can be obtained, and that the draft amendment should be broadened to include other persons known or connected to the examiner. In respect of Clause 5, the cancellation or suspension of registration of officers, the question was posed whether why only persons who were convicted of Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 offences in the Criminal Act are prohibited, and why not the other schedules in the Act as well. Clause 9, it comes to the registration of manufacturers, builders, importers, and manufacturers of number plates. The input was that the number plates are no longer administered by the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, and that this has caused a huge challenge in the enforcement of the regulation of number plates. And that the committee must also consider to widen the scope for approval and monitoring of embossers. In respect of the registration of driving license centres, given that only a provincial department responsible for transport or municipality may operate a driving license testing centre, clarity is sought on the future of driving license testing centres that are intended to be operated by national state departments such as SAPS and the South African National Defence Force. And clarity is requested in respect of the rationale for not including national departments. The inputs from the industry in respect of the application of an issue of driving license, the bill makes provision for the driving test centers to provide a motor vehicle for a person doing the test. And the view from industry is that these driving license test centers authorities would then be directly competing with driving schools and driving school businesses, which will be negatively affected. And they view this as essentially being unfair competition that is being created. So Clause 40, Chair, you will recall that, and members, this is where a lot of the email submissions objected to the bill too. So Clause 40 provides that any vehicle driven by a person responding to a disaster, as contemplated in the Disaster Management Act, may disregard the directions of a road's traffic sign, which is displayed in a prescribed manner. It's a very strong sense that this provision is open for potential abuse and creates a safety risk on the roads. The view is that it will result in reckless driving, accidents and death, may create loopholes for abuse by a number of the persons referred to as blue light brigades, transporting ministers and office bearers, and that the definition of disaster needs to be clear to avoid abuse of the clause. And furthermore, that caution must still apply, and such people should be given advanced or defensive driving training as well as a permit to present to police if stopped. Okay, so that was essentially the clauses that received the most amount of attention during the submissions. We will hear further detail from Kosatu and Prof. Perice, and on the 14th, the department will return to the committee with a detailed overview of their response to the submissions received. Thank you, Tri.
Thank you, Doc, for taking us through the written submissions that were made and the approach that let's members note any clarification questions that they want to raise in regard to the presentations made. And then move to the next item, which will be the oral submission by the Medical Research Council, which will be led by Professor Perry. I see the hand of Honorable Lund. Honorable Lund?
Thank you, Chair. It's just a short note, but I did like that one slide giving the breakdown of the submissions received, the quantities, the percentages, and an Honorable Chai is online as well and some of the other stuff, but that is something going forward as well, that we have that quantitative measure as well. Obviously, the content thereof, we can then debate, but that is, I want to say thanks for that and also going forward, because that gives a nice, quick overview of what's going on, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Lund, for that comment. Let's then, if Professor Perry is ready, she can ascend to the platform.
Professor, thank you very much. Thank you.
Welcome, Prof.
Good morning, honorable members. Can I present my slides? Is it possible to show it somehow? Or I did send them through. Could someone else put them up?
I suggest that they give you hosting rights so that you can run the presentation from your side, Prof.
Okay. I put them up. Could let me know if you can see them. Thank you.
Thank you. We can see them. Over to you.
Thank you. Great. I think I have about 12 slides. It's not too many. So I'm going to be commenting, and particularly, as was mentioned, referring to the reduction of blood alcohol levels permissible in drivers, which was removed from a previous version of this bill, I believe, by the Assembly. And I'm calling for the reinstatement of that at a slightly different level, as was said by Dr. Clark. So I'm just moving my slide down. So I'm going to be covering these points very briefly, my credentials, then my main proposal, talk about public support for lower levels of blood alcohol concentration, experience from other countries that have lowered blood alcohol concentration levels, then summarize that experience and the impact of increasing BAC levels on deaths, and then some key recommendations and some concluding comments very briefly. So I really won't go into much detail here. You can read some of my credentials. I'm the director of the Mental Health Alcohol Substance Use and Tobacco Research Unit at the MRC since 2021. I'm a professor in psychiatry at Stellenbosch University, registered psychologist, published over 300 articles in the substance abuse field, mainly alcohol, been working with the WHO, a member of the Global Alcohol Policy Alliance, and worked extensively in South Africa at local government, provincial and national government around alcohol policy in different government departments. So my main suggestion is to recommend, basically, going beyond suggesting, that the National Council of Provinces refer the bill back to the other house to have the provisions of the original bill indicating a lowering of the allowable concentration of maximum allowable concentration of alcohol in the blood of ordinary drivers, which was proposed to be go down to zero alcohol in the blood, to lower it to 0.02 to allow for detecting minimal amounts of alcohol from, for example, medicines. But on various objections or various inputs, the committee decided to take these provisions out. And I'm going to basically recommending that they be reinstated. So basically, I'm strongly in favor of decreasing permissible blood alcohol concentration levels from the current 0.05 to reduce the heavy burden associated by South Africa in terms of loss of life, injury, damage to property, and economic costs, which I won't go into. This will take the guesswork out of drivers having to estimate whether they're under the current 0.05 threshold. Basically, we're separating drinking and driving. This will send out a message that drinking and driving don't go together. However, from a practical point of view, my written submission indicates that we should consider making the maximum level 0.02 or only taking action when that threshold is exceeded. And I'll go into more details on that. So on the left is a publication that I co-authored, but what came out of it was a representative household survey of almost 2,000 adult drinkers in Tshwane conducted by my unit in 2014 found that over half supported or strongly supported lowering allowable blood alcohol concentrations for drivers. They felt the 0.05 level should be reduced. A further 17 said they were neutral, and only 28% said they were opposed to lowering BAC levels. So this is of drinkers in Tshwane, a representative sample. If we did bring our level down, it would bring us in line with 23 other countries around the world, including Brazil, which we're part of BRICS. And there are 12 other countries with BAC levels at 0.02, also including China, which is a member of BRICS, Sweden and Norway, for example. I'm just going to refer to country data. We'll first refer to Brazil. In June 2008, they dropped the permissible blood alcohol concentration in drivers to 0.02, which is what I'm recommending for South Africa. And in an article published in Addiction, they did a time series analysis to study the effect of the legislative change of dropping that BAC level in both the state of Brazil and the capital city of Sao Paulo to investigate traffic injuries and fatalities on a monthly basis over over a 10 and a half year period. And the new traffic law of reducing it to 0.02 was responsible for significant reductions in traffic injuries and fatalities in both the state and the city of Sao Paulo. A stronger effect was observed for traffic fatalities, a minus 7.2% drop in traffic deaths in the state, and this minus 16% drop in traffic related deaths in the capital. And then an article in the Bulletin of the World Health Organization said that since the law was implemented, the Ministry of Health data from Brazil shows a 32% drop in road deaths in Rio de Janeiro state, compared to a decline in only 6.2% in states where they haven't enforced the dry law. So they didn't all enforce it equally. So certainly some benefit in dropping the 2.02. In Japan and Sweden, in Japan, permissible BAC levels were changed to 0.03 in 2002, and research has shown a reduction in all alcohol-related and non-alcohol-related traffic injuries since that law was imposed. And in Sweden, dropping the level to 0.02 in 1990 reduced fatal crashes by 6%. And finally, the USA and Australia. In the USA, some states have zero tolerance laws for young or novice drivers. Zero tolerance means no alcohol is permitted while you drive. And the first 12 states to enact this legislation found a 20% reduction in single vehicle nighttime fatal crashes amongst drivers under 21 years of age, compared to control states which didn't implement such a zero tolerance for young drivers. And a later international study found a 24% decrease in the number of young drivers with positive BAC laws as a result of zero tolerance laws. And then a review of research in Australia and the US found reductions between 9% and 24% in fatal crashes associated with the implementation of zero tolerance laws for young people. So certainly some quite very substantial effects of reducing the levels to 0.02 or 0.03 and then or to zero in novice drivers provided in this review. So what's the summary of the experience in a nutshell? Depending on which study you're looking at, reductions between 6% and 32% in fatal crashes have been obtained by reducing BAC levels to 0.02, 0.03, or even going as far as zero. Basically, when you look at the impact of alcohol on people's functioning, a study done by the a UK group called the National Institute for Healthcare and Excellence found that drivers with a BAC of 0.02 to 0.05, which is the area we're talking about changing the legislation for, have more than three times greater risk for dying in a vehicle crash compared to persons with no alcohol in their blood. And the risk increases to more than six times if you go above 0.05 to 0.08 and so forth. But we're not looking at that particularly in the legislation. We already have a 0.05. Level, which could be better enforced. So my key recommendations, I think this is my last two slides, deal with what level we should have, the issue of different sanctions depending on where you get where your alcohol level is found, and the importance of other interventions, and the issue of mandatory testing at crash sites. And I'm not sure if this committee can look into all of these, but I certainly would just like to make these points. Given the possibility of blood alcohol concentration tests being positive as a result of drivers consuming medications containing alcohol or small trace amounts from drinking even 12 hours previously, my recommendation in the MRCs is that the threshold for taking punitive action be 0.02. So we drop the level back to where it was in the version 7 of the bill from 2020. Brazil has done this. They've considered differentiating between drivers who've a blood alcohol concentration between 0.02 and 0.06, and those above 0.06, at 0.06 or above. And the first group are dealt with administratively. They get a fine, whereas those with blood alcohol concentrations in Brazil over 0.06 or go to the criminal court. And I think that's something we should really consider. I know the AA, the Automobile Association, was concerned with increasing criminalization of drivers if we drop the BAC level. And that was their major objection to dropping it between 0.05. But I think we could deal with that by only having fines or administrative sanctions for people who are found to have blood alcohol levels between 0.02 and 0.05. That'll reduce the burden on the police, the courts, and prevent people from being criminalized for levels between 0.02 and 0.05. But we'll still get the benefits of reducing BAC levels in terms of reducing deaths, harms, and economic costs. So I undertook in 2019 an umbrella review of systematic reviews of alcohol control interventions, which suggests that reducing BAC limits alone may not be as successful if they're not combined with other interventions, such as increasing police controls, increasing testing, things like mandatory ignition locks, where someone who's previously been found to be driving over the limit, then the court mandates that they have something called an interlock put on their car, so that you have to blow into this machine. It tests your blood alcohol levels, and only if you're below a certain level will it allow the car to start. So the recommendation is if we drop the blood alcohol level to 0.02, we institute things like mandatory interlocks for people who've been previously tested, and we increase police patrols, increase things like awareness campaigns, as well as dropping the blood alcohol level. And then the other point, which I think is a bit of a no-brainer, is to consider mandatory alcohol testing of drivers at all serious motor vehicle crash sites, where someone is seriously injured, killed, or where there's serious damage to property. I think we need to know the alcohol burden, and we need to use that in sanctions against people who are taken to court in such instances. Finally, sorry, my last slide, is this one here, and I'm going to put up my, sorry, you can't see my last slide, can you? I'm going to put it up. Okay, now, can you see it?
Yes.
Thank you. My last slide is that going ahead with this approach to drop the maximum blood alcohol concentration to 0.02 would send out a clear message that drinking and driving don't go together. It would affect many of us. I mean, I consume alcohol. I would just then basically not be able to drink and drive. I'd have to find alternative transport or get someone else to drive me. It would address concerns about drivers being caught with small amounts of alcohol from medicines. It would also address the issue of criminalizing people, because we wouldn't criminalize people between 0.02 and 0.05. But the impact, it would be only meaningful if there was a commitment to enforcement and ensuring adequate mechanisms to ensure that testing equipment is available and properly calibrated. And I think, and finally, not taking the opportunity, it's really before your committee, otherwise I think it's dead in the water, not taking this opportunity to reduce maximum BAC levels for drivers will be a missed opportunity to have an impact on the approximately 14,000 road deaths a year, where it's been said that almost 60% of all collisions on our roads can be attributable to alcohol. And where even Arrive Alive has reported that half the people who die on our roads have blood alcohol levels above the legal limit of 0.05. So I think it's before your committee to decide if they really want to take this opportunity to make this impact and have an impact on reducing alcohol-related harm on our roads and elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Prof, for the taking us through the overview of our presentation. We really appreciate the thrust of the presentation, the scanning over the global a picture in terms of what is the situation in relation to blood alcohol level, the key recommendations, the approach, and then the recommendations we are making. We appreciate that. I just need to check, because we had agreed that we need to take all the presentation and then allow members to participate in question. Is Prof comfortable with that? You don't have any other pleasure?
Well, that's fine. I can stay on until 10:40 easily.
Okay. That's fine. Then let's then agree to take another presentation from Kusatu. Pax.
Good morning to members. Yeah, we can start with our presentation. Just allow me to upload it quickly.
Welcome, Pax.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thanks, Chair, for giving us a space, Kusatu, just to share our views on what we think is a very critical bill for society, for workers, for the economy, for the state, etc. I think, Chair, it's also been quite beneficial just to hear the input of the MRC. And I think their kind of expertise is quite valuable. And I think that we have a lot of synergy with the issues they have raised. And I think we're better off having listened to them as well. So, Chair, also let me just say great members and great colleagues from Parliament and from government. So I think, Chair, for us as a bill, we had engaged on it at NEDAC a few years ago, as well as at the National Assembly. And our premise is guided by the fact that we lose about 14,000 deaths every year on road accidents, be it drivers, passengers, pedestrians, and so forth. And this is obviously a very painful, but also equally a very needless loss for those families. Who, you know, children lose parents, breadwinners. This threatens the survival of these families economically when they lose breadwinners. There's a huge cost to them, to the medical costs and so forth. It costs the economy billions of rands in lost wages and productivity and so forth. There's a huge burden to the fiscus. We have the Road Accident Fund, which, you know, is mired with issues of corruption and mismanagement and so forth. But it also has liabilities which have now exceeded about 400 billion rand. And as a consequence, you then find part of the taxes for the fuel price regime goes to the road levy, which funds the RAF. I think we all know, as you know, many instances of traffic testing centers, traffic officers, and allegations of corruption. So we support this bill, Chair. We think it's long overdue, it's progressive, and necessary. So we have two areas of concern around it. I think the first one, which we agree really with the MRC's input, and I think we really welcome it. So for us, Chair, we're really appalled by the abuse of alcohol in society. You know, we think about 25% of road accidents, whether it's pedestrians or drivers or passengers, is as a result of abuse of alcohol. We think that clearly the existing limits and the enforcement are clearly not sufficient. There's too much ambiguity around the current blood alcohol level. In terms of your weight, your age, your type of alcohol, etc. We think, Chair, that also there's a need for law to be ruthlessly enforced, especially for young people and for professional drivers. And I think some of the examples mentioned by the MRC internationally are also quite useful. So we were supporting this bill, and it's particularly the clause removing any content from alcohol, from the blood of alcohol. We were really quite dismayed at the National Assembly's deletion of the clause 46. We understand the issue of medication and so forth. That's fine. But we clearly the system right now is broken. We can't be content as a society when every single year we see about 14,000 deaths on the roads. And again, alcohol is a key part of it. I think we saw during COVID-19 the positive effects when we actually began to take this crisis of alcohol abuse seriously. So I think, Chair, our proposal on this front on the issue of drinking and driving is to reinsert clause 46 to deal with the issue of the current levels of blood, of alcohol in our blood. So we had originally proposed, Chair, that this simply reinstates that clause of no alcohol in your blood content. You know, but having just listened now to in the MRC, if the committee was to say, let's go take the MRC's proposal of 0.02, we would think that would equally do the justice, would do the job, and would equally be a very progressive solution, Chair. So I think for us, but we can't simply say the status quo is acceptable. And there are acceptable, you know, positive examples. We could look at internationally, for example, like Sweden and so forth, which has also taken a zero tolerance approach and has had very positive consequences to it. Chair, just on the issue of the regulation and the requirements for traffic schools, we think the provisions are positive. They provide a clear criteria and conditions for driver education schools, which is needed. They provide positive standards for driving instructors, then empowering government to deal with the issue of offending schools. And I think we all know many stories about schools which are corrupt, which have an unhealthy relationship with testing centers. We need to make sure that we teach learners properly, and we need to deal with the issue of collusion with corrupt officials. And I think, Chair, we all know this is one of the reasons why we have a huge number of reckless drivers on our roads. And again, this is a public safety risk. So we support these provisions on the schools, and we think the enforcement must also be equally efficient as well, given that lives are at risk. Chair, on the issue of the business interests for traffic officials, we support those. This is a problem throughout the state and, in fact, throughout society, where we have a cancer of corruption into every fabric of our lives, and our moral ethics are being eroded. So we support the provisions providing for a prohibition for traffic officials, vehicle and licensing officials from having business or financial interest in the sector. We know it's not going to be easy to enforce, but I think it's the right message and it's the right step forward. We simply can't afford officials to have financial conflicts of interest, and this is a necessary anti-corruption provision. And again, it needs to be enforced. Chair, I think if you look at the issue of impounding or unroadworthy vehicles, I think we know the conditions on the roads in our townships and rural areas in particular, where we see many, many vehicles which are just blatantly unroadworthy. And again, Chair, we see often reckless drivers continue to be allowed to drive these. So we think we want to welcome the provisions allowing traffic officials to be empowered to impound these vehicles as necessary, especially on serious transit transgressions. And of course, you just must make sure that these are not abused by traffic officials to extort bribes. So there must be some measures in regulations and management to prevent corruption and so forth. On the licensing plate manufacturing, again, this is a public security issue. We have huge problems of illegal vehicles being stolen and transported legally to neighboring states, especially Zimbabwe and Mozambique. So the manufacture of license plates, we agree, needs to be strictly regulated and enforced. Again, poor quality license plates also makes it difficult to enforce traffic laws. The issue of fake and duplicate stolen license plates is a real problem. So I think we want to welcome the provisions to tightly manage the sector. And so we support these provisions as necessary and long overdue. Chair, again, on the issue of weigh bridges, I mean, this has been a significant public safety issue. It's been a significant risk to truck drivers. So we do welcome the provisions for a much tighter regulation and oversight of the weigh bridges. Often we've seen the quality testing very lackluster or poor, often riddled with corruption, asking for bribes from drivers. And again, Chair, this poses a risk to the lives of those drivers and of course to all road users. And again, has an impact upon the deterioration of our roads prematurely. And again, a significant cost to lives, state, and the economy. The driver's cancellation issue is not a light issue, Chair, and it must be handled quite sensitively. We need to make sure it's not abused for caution, et cetera. But we think the measures provided for are fair. They take the right balance. You know, including, for example, on the issue of no longer being able to physically drive, those are long overdue, and it's strange we haven't had them before. So I think, Chair, just the specific conditions we think they need to find space in the regulations is around the issues of appeals, for example, because you do want to avoid unintended consequences where workers who depend upon having driver's licenses to travel or to perform their work, et cetera, to retain their jobs, must have some sort of mechanisms which are fair and accessible for appeals where relevant. And of course, you know, we should make sure there are mechanisms and management to avoid any elements of corruption that's seeping in. Chair, again, the issue of the, you know, provisions for the learners and driving testing, they're quite strict. And again, we think they're long overdue. They're straightforward, they're common sense. And again, they speak to a situation where we have corruption at driving testing centers and so forth. And again, the society pays the consequence when there are people who are simply not properly trained and who are now driving on the roads. We think there's a similar need, again, Chair, around the PDPs. Provisions are straightforward and common sense. We do need to make sure the regulations are reviewed and overhauled because we think at times we have been a little bit cavalier, where often it's easier to get PDPs than normal driving licenses. Chair, we think it needs to be a bit stricter because you're not just driving yourself or your immediate passengers, but you're driving a large amount of commuters and so forth. And we often, I think we've seen, Chair, people who drive buses, for example, driving in a very reckless manner. And this poses a risk to the passengers, to society at large. So we need to see in the regulations a much stricter approach to the testing for PDPs. Chair, I think, you know, Dr. Clark, I think, gave a useful kind of summary of the emergency vehicle provisions. You know, we welcome the provisions. Our concern, Chair, there really was around our members who are from Pop Crew, who are members of the SEPS VIP Protection Unit. Chair, I think we've often seen bearers die unnecessarily with the drivers with them because of speeding. Chair, we all remember painfully the issue of Collins Chobani, Molefe Sefolaro, I think even recently, the MEC Tate Makgwe, many others who have died unnecessarily because of driving. Often the issue of speeding, dangerous driving has been involved. We often have had complaints from our members who are officers in the VIP Protection Unit who are saying that, look, we are told by politicians we must drive at 160 to get to whatever meeting they're late to. And we don't think that should be allowed. We always express platitudes when this members die, but nothing is done afterwards. Chair, we think we need to set up a stronger example and amend the provisions on emergency vehicles with an additional sub-clause, which simply says that this excludes SAPS VIP members, driving politicians or whomever, and who are not responding to an actual emergency. They should not be exempt from the traffic laws, from the speeding regulations, etc. Yes, you would want, for example, the protectors of a president, if his life is in danger, to be allowed. But if a minister or MEC is simply traveling to a branch meeting, wherever, and they're late, that should not constitute an emergency and they shouldn't then be exempt. Chair, just on the issue, getting towards the end, on the issue of the import exemptions, we think the provisions, allowing a person to apply for exemptions to the minister for vehicles not meeting our road requirements are a little bit vague. And perhaps in the regulations, the conditions for those exemptions should be specified. They shouldn't infringe upon public around road safety for vehicle or passengers or under environmental laws. So you don't want dumping of vehicles that don't meet our laws in the country. But we also don't want to see a minister be giving a blank check. What's in the check? Because the motor manufacturing industry is a huge part of our economy. We've often seen companies from overseas wanting to dump vehicles here and undermine our efforts to grow and to support this critical and strategic sector of the economy. So, Chair, just in conclusion, we support this progressive bill. We think it's long overdue. It should be passed by Parliament, enacted by the President and so forth timelessly, and of course implemented by the state. We really want to oppose the lobbying by the liquor industry, which we think is simply fixated on profits from liquor sales at the expense of saving lives. So we want to see how can we strengthen the bill's progressive provisions. We had wanted to see Clause 46 dealing with the issue of alcohol and blood content levels being reinserted. We had wanted to go to the zero level, but we'd also support the call for the MRC for 0.02. We really want to urge the NCP to take that on board. And of course, a clause protecting SAPS VIP officers from having to break speed limits and traffic laws in non-emergencies. But Chair, having said this, you can pass this, Parliament will pass this progressive law, but we do need to see the states then, national, provincial, so forth, local, having public education campaigns to make sure officials are aware, road users are aware of their legal obligations. We also see government beginning to take road safety much more seriously and to invest in the capacitation and the resourcing of road traffic enforcement. We have many municipalities, about 27 municipalities right now, which are no longer able to pay their staff members. So we really need to see a much more pragmatic approach to how we resource the public service and the local government. But we think the lackadaisical approach currently of government is really unnecessary, condemning thousands to premature deaths and causing the economy billions of rands. So let me stop there, Chair, and apologies if I went over my time limit slightly. But thanks very much to the members, Chair.
Thank you, Hans, for the for taking us through the presentation on behalf of SATU. Like I did indicate what we can do, we'll then request honorable members to raise any clarification question that they have in relation to the presentations. I've seen Honorable Dango, I've seen Honorable Lord, I've seen Honorable Khai, I've seen Honorable Boshoff. Let's move in that fashion, Honorable Khai. Honorable Dango.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think we need to welcome the presentations, particularly the one from COSATU, which actually was very, very pointed and made some very positive recommendations. Having said that, I think the issue of the blood alcohol level at 0.2% should be supported at this particular point in time. Chairperson, I have another question. The question of blue lights that was raised by COSATU. I noticed that private security companies are now using blue lights. Is this permissible? Or should that not be prohibited? Because it's confusing policing and law enforcement duties with what private security companies are doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Dango. Honorable Lord.
Thank you, Chair. Just a bit of tongue in check, Honorable Dango. Nobody is actually supposed to use it, especially politicians, because it's getting abused. And that's probably why there was such massive pushback on that, what, that one section. But what I do fully agree with is the enforcement capabilities. And that is a big thing, Chair, that we can actually advocate. Maybe even say, listen, get devolution to capable municipalities and provinces, more powers to them. So that is something that we must talk to possibly. But there's on the first presentation, there's a question that just popped up, and I don't know if the professor has the answer on that, but the percentages that he touched on about the fatalities of drunk driving, is that just drunk driving or drunk drivers, or does that include jaywalking? Because that's also a massive problem. And then people that get intoxicated and get involved in accidents. So I just want to find out, does that affect his stats, or did he bring that into consideration? But on the two, I do appreciate the input. It was really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Lord. Honorable Khail.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Good morning to you, Honorable members, and the staff of the Committee on Parliament, as well as our stakeholders. I just want to find out, my question is directed to COSATU, as to whether the bill has been at NEDLAC, and also the second question, whether there has been any socioeconomic impact assessment that was done on the bill. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Khair. Honorable Bosho.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to everybody. I'd just like to know, we speak about the alcohol levels being dropped, which I agree with, but I'd just like to know how we're going to differentiate between medication and alcohol levels, because you can be stopped and you could have taken some medication, and then you have a record against your name because it has now been determined that your alcohol level is above the threshold. So if I could just be given an answer to that, thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Worship. From my side, the first one relates to Professor Perry, the household survey that was done in Tshwane in 2014, whether the survey was able to make a breakdown between the young people and the elders, or it was just a random survey used irrespective as to making a distinction between the young drivers and the elders that are driving, and then the second one, I see the comparative analysis done only relates to countries outside Africa. Is there any reason? Or is there any information that we have that could share light to us in relation to what is the situation in relation to the blood alcohol level in African countries? Other than that, let's then give over to Professor Perry to respond, and then we'll then give over to Mark.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Okay, let me respond. There are, I think, about three or four questions that I can deal with quite quickly. The one question from Honorable Lant about whether the information on reductions in fatalities or effects on injuries was everybody or just drivers. Whenever I gave the information and I didn't say drivers, it relates to everybody. So it was reduction in fatalities on the road of people who died on the road, whether they were a pedestrian, a passenger, or a driver. But in some cases, I did refer specifically to drivers. But otherwise, it was to all road users. The other issue of Honorable Boshoff about medication, I think, is a good issue, which people are concerned about. Many of us take medication sometimes, and sometimes there is a bit of alcohol in it. So that's why we made the recommendation to not basically take action against anybody with alcohol levels below 0.02, which would really pretty much cover those people who are taking medications, unless they are just drinking bottle after bottle of Fensidryl, which would be abusive medication. So generally you wouldn't test above 0.02 for taking a medication, or if you have, you know, a single chocolate with some alcohol in it. But we also are also mindful that we don't want to criminalize people for very low levels of alcohol. So that's why the recommendation was that there wouldn't be any record, basically, or criminal record on anybody who would be prosecuted for an offense for drinking for an alcohol level between 0.02 and 0.05. It would be like a road traffic fine. Many of us on occasion get speeding fines and we don't have a criminal record for that, but we pay a fine and we hopefully learn our lesson and drive more carefully on roads. The question from the chair about young people, the Tshwane survey, we looked at people 15 and older. We do have the information on those between 15 and 18, but I don't have it in at hand. I'd have to reanalyze the data to see if young people specifically were less opposed, for example, to, because I said that 55% of this representative survey, it was a very big survey of about 2,000 people, whether the young people differed, and I'd have to go back into that data, but I suspect that the young people might have been, you know, it may have been less, slightly less than 55% supporting it. We certainly found I think it was increasing excise taxes on alcohol, the young people were less supportive of the policy reforms. As regards your point about countries outside of Africa, unfortunately, that's a problem with much research when we look at the effect of interventions. A lot of it is done in countries in the north or in Australia. And there is, as I said, there's research from Brazil. And so often we have to look to Brazil. But this is an issue. I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was at World Health Organization. I was a trainer at a World Health Organization meeting on road safety, which included a section on alcohol. And the countries there was Ghana, Ethiopia, Uganda and Kenya. And there's not great data, but it's certainly something I recommended very strongly when I gave my presentations. We've got to measure what we're doing, because we can't measure it. We can't really, it's harder to change if you're not showing that you're having an impact. Thank you.
Maybe just the last one before I give over to Pasatu. The rationale behind behind reverting back to 0.05, what could be the reasons? I think you could be able to share just in terms of probably the what could also have led to the to Parliament to set the level at 0.05. Any signs or information on that?
I haven't got hard data on that, and also maybe my colleague from COSATU would be willing to comment on that. But certainly when I looked at the concerns of the Automobile Association, the issue was they didn't want their members stopped and criminalized, pestered by police. But, I don't, as I said, if you dropped it to 0.02 and you only had criminal sanctions above 0.05, you wouldn't be criminalizing people. We don't feel criminalized when we get caught for speeding. It's something we need to it's like a slap on the wrist, and we need to sort it out, and it's not such a harsh sentence. So I think we can address that concern by the only having administrative sanctions. I suspect, as Matthews Park said, there was a lot of lobbying by the liquor industry and the liquor retailers, because they feel that, and we had the same when there was bans on tobacco smoking in bars, the establishments felt that they would lose a lot of business. But I think we have to weigh it up that driving is on our roads is a privilege, and we have a huge burden in terms of alcohol-related offences. And certainly, I think they're more concerned about making profits than about the health and welfare of the people of the country. So I think there are ways around it. We need to improve public transport. We need to have designated drivers. But I think we can't go on with the current situation. As for other reasons, I think another reason that's often given is that enforcement of the 0.05 level is not done very well. So why would we want to drop it to 0.02? But it's like saying, well, maybe we shouldn't stop people at the roads because, there will be corruption and police officers might want bribes. We have to address those problems as separate issues. They're not the same issue. We need to increase enforcement, random breath testing. It has happened in certain provinces at certain times. And it in the Western Cape, for example, many years back, there was a lot more aggressive policing of drink driving regulations. And I think we saw a reduction of road traffic collisions and that at that time. So enforcement, we shouldn't say that bad enforcement is a reason that we're not going to lower the BAC level.
Thank you, Prof, for that response. Okay, let's give over to Matthew Parks.
Thanks, Chen. Thanks to the honourable member for the questions. I think it's always very positive in the NCOP when you see members across political party line, I think having consensus on the key issues facing us. And I think for us, that is exactly what it is. Traffic is a huge crisis for all of us. So, Chair, I think just on the issues, other on the blood alcohol content, I mean, I think most members raised it. I think we have a choice. We can be content with the status quo, 14,000 deaths on the road, about a quarter or higher, be it road or be it pedestrian or passengers, linked to alcohol abuse. And that's fine. We can be content with that. We can be content with a road accident fund, liabilities of 400 billion rand, the cost to families, the economy, to businesses, etc. But I think most of us, and I think members are positive in the responses, most members, I think, are not content with it. So I think, Chair, that's why for us, we thought the status quo isn't working. We want to see, we had hoped to see the previous clause being reduced to zero contact, but we do take a medication issue. And I think the comments from Prof. Perry are helpful from the MRC perspective, that it is a fair compromise could be a 0.02% that can address Honorable Bostoff's concern about the medication issue, to avoiding people who simply took Panado or whatever medication, etc. And I think that Prof. Perry, I think, is coming with a very interesting, nuanced approach, to say have a three-pronged approach or legal regime, so to speak, that people who have below 0.02% alcohol content in the blood, that's fine, there's no problem. If you have between 0.02 and 0.05, for example, you could be dealt with administrative, like a fine, like a traffic fine, etc. So it's not a criminal issue. But then those who are clearly having above 0.05, then we need to look at a more stricter regime. I think, Chair, for us, that's a positive, a nuanced, a pragmatic approach. But I think, Chair, for us, the bottom line is that the status quo has a heavy cost to families, to society, to the economy, to the fiscus. I think, Chair, for us, the National Assembly made a mistake, with the greatest of respect to the members there, to simply repeal that clause. They should have rather looked at a fairer compromise like the MRC is proposing. And yes, you know, Chair, members are right to say we must also capacity the state around enforcement. But it's not just around this law, it's around all laws that we pass progressive laws, but then we don't invest in the public services, or including local government, to make sure they have the capacity to enforce. But I think, Chair, the bottom line is that we are far too tolerant as a society around the abuse of alcohol. Whether it's around domestic violence, gender-based violence, whether it's around drunken driving, et cetera. And I think we saw during COVID-19, when the state took very harsh actions, there was immediate positive response. We're not saying we must go back to that kind of regime is not sustainable. There is a space in society for responsible consumption of liquor. Or Ms. Kosato, we have members in the liquor value chain, from the farms to the retail, manufacturing, bottling, et cetera. And there's no problem with that, but we need to find the right relationship with alcohol. And currently our relationship is not a good one. Chair, just to Honorable Khai's questions, yes, the bill came to NEDLAC. We had engaged on it extensively in NEDLAC. And I, without speaking for government, I recall there was a CS done for this bill. And I think it was tabled at the National Assembly as well. That's my recollection. Chair, doesn't the last issue on the issue of the abuse of blue lights. So I think we welcome the kind of provisions in the bill around the issue of emergency vehicles and so forth. And look, the reality is we have private security, significant industry. We also have private ambulance or medical emergency vehicles as well, which are also growing quite significantly. So obviously ambulances, be it public or private, would need to have the emergency lights. And I think the regulations can provide for that kind of, you know, how it can be done, et cetera. But I think, Chair, we're Honorable Alont is right about the abuse of the emergency lights. We have seen many people who have nothing to do with emergency vehicles having these lights. So I think there is a need to deal with those manufacturers and to deal with those persons. I think, Chair, lastly, you know, I don't want to get into trouble with my comrades, but I think if I can recall correctly, in 2009 in the Western Cape, after the elections, the provincial government took a stance to remove the blue lights from the vehicles for MECs. Perhaps one doesn't need to go to that extreme, but I think the intention was correct of the provincial government to say that when VIP protection officers are transporting political office bearers, be it national, provincial, whomever, that does not constitute an emergency. And should not be utilized, etc. So I think, Chair, that's why we've said let's have some additional sub clause to say that transporting of political office bearers does not constitute an emergency unless there's a threat to life, etc. But yeah, I think that's the question, Chair. I think just to thank members for the positive comments, and we're hopeful that we could find some sort of a compromise to reinsert some sort of a clause 46, perhaps along the lines that the MRC is proposed, which were really felt are very helpful, Chairperson members. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew, for that. I see there are follow-up questions. There are new hands, and as with the other one will be follow-up. Tim, floor is yours.
And first of all, I'd like to just apologize to the committee. I was blissfully unaware that we were starting at 9 o'clock this morning. And I do really apologize. I suppose I'm a creature of habit, expecting a 10 o'clock start. So I do apologize to everybody. I was not being disrespectful. Chairperson, Jaco launches a point of order.
Point of order, can we check if he didn't set his alarm for 9:50?
Continue, Tim.
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you. I will not take a question from the Honourable Lord. Chairperson, it's not often that I would agree with Kosatu. But an issue I just want to... Well, first of all, my question to Professor Parry is... look, my interaction with medical personnel about the 0.02 limit... but this evidence is just anecdotal, is that it would be very unusual for medication to take you over that limit I'm talking about like a Vicks Medi-Night or some sort of alcohol-based cough mixture that would take you over that. And in fact, if you are taking a scheduled drug that takes you over that limit, you probably shouldn't be driving anyway. So, you know, until the effects wear off. But that's just anecdotal. So I just have one question to Professor Perry. Is whether any clinical trials have actually been done, i.e. giving a person a dose of strong cough mixture and then testing their blood alcohol limit to see whether or not it comes into it. But I'm comfortable that the sort of grace provision between 0.02 and 0.05 is there, because in any case, you could challenge any fine in court, just like you can challenge a speeding fine in court and provide evidence that you're on medication. So I'm comfortable with that, but it would be interesting to know if any actual clinical trials were done, because the evidence that I have from medical personnel, doctors, et cetera, is simply anecdotal. But I just want to come back to my agreement with Kosatu, is that the fundamental problem that we're picking up in my province of KZN is one of enforcement. And I've raised this in speeches and in questions in the House. The road traffic inspector in KZN is severely understaffed, and the staff that are there are underpaid, and they are also not paid overtime. And as a result, I can assure you now, in Durban, I have not seen a roadblock in Durban for ages, simply because they can't get staff out on the road after hours, simply because they're not paid overtime. And then also for a very long period of time, extended period of time, we had no breathalyzer test kits in KZN. And this is a massive enforcement problem. So you can change these sections of the legislation. If you don't have the enforcement, it's a complete waste of time, because it simply is just not being enforced because there are no breathalyzer kits. And I think that's massively problematic. And then also, there's other flag I need to raise, and it doesn't fall within this legislation, but there are massive issues in terms of overloading of vehicles. And I believe that the department should be looking very carefully at automated systems in vehicles that do not allow the vehicle to start if it's overloaded. In other words, a passenger carrying vehicle, such as a Quantum or the like. And then also unroadworthy vehicles are a massive problem on the road. And whenever you have these massive pile-ups in KZN, you often find that the trucks are unroadworthy, the brakes are not up to scratch, and then also that there is not proper truck driver training. A massive truck that is carrying a 60-ton load or a 10-ton load or even a 20-ton load cannot stop with its brakes. It simply cannot stop with its brakes. When you try and apply brakes in a heavy vehicle like that, they simply turn to gloss, and they're absolutely useless. You have to use cadence braking. You have to use exhaust braking, and that comes with training and the right systems on the actual heavy-duty trucks. And this is where you have unskilled drivers. The terrible, terrible case in 2013 in Pinetown where about 30 people were killed in a matter of seconds by a truck that came through an intersection when I was actually the councillor in that area. That was a driver that had been given, it was his first drive for that particular company. And he did not have a driver's license. And I just want to raise those flags. Those are the kind of flags that we need to put serious enforcement efforts into, is overloaded vehicles, unroadworthy vehicles, and drivers driving vehicles and simply not being trained for them. And there is there are many other provisions in our laws relating to hazardous materials and the kind of training that drivers should go through when they're driving a truck that's carrying hazardous materials. Those laws are there, but the enforcement simply doesn't happen. And those drivers simply are not trained. The trucking industry just does not attend to them simply because there's no enforcement. So I just want to raise those flags, but generally also to say that the DA position on both these bills that we're discussing today is positive, and we do affirm them and support them. But other than the question about the clinical trials, I just want to raise those flags with the committee that we must not assume that if we're just changing the blood alcohol limit that everything's going to come right on our roads. There are many, many other issues that cause road fatalities. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Tim. Honorable Dango.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Honorable Tim, for not politicizing transport and death like others do. Chairperson, there is the question of heavy-duty truck drivers that are tired. Is there any way of regulating that? Because these truck drivers travel long distances, are tired, and actually are a danger on the road. So I think we need to just look at that. Maybe there should be two drivers on such a truck, or maybe the driver should be compelled to stop at every so now and then when that is determined. On the question of blue lights, for example, there's a security company at OR Tambo. It's not more than 5 kilometers. They're a private security company and they abuse the blue lights. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you, Honorable Dango. Prof?
Thank you. The question from Honorable Rousseff, some good points there. Firstly, the clinical trials. Generally, clinical trials are undertaken to assess whether a certain intervention is effective or not. So obviously, one wouldn't have an intervention to assess the whether it wouldn't look at the issue in the way that he's talking about alcohol in medication. But in terms of research, I mean, I think it's a good question. The research has tended to focus on the interaction of alcohol with existing medication. It hasn't looked at the different levels. I think your question related more to has research been done on, if I'm correct, on how much alcohol there is in medication and how does that affect people's behavior? I mean, obviously it's done to the point that there are inserts in medication saying that, this medication will make you drowsy. But I don't think it's really been done quite in the way that he's indicated. It's part of an adverse effect, the study of adverse effects. So yes, there have been, you're right, there have been clinical trials and they look at the use of alcohol. They look at medications as a whole and the adverse effects, and the alcohol part would come up, particularly infecting coordination and drowsiness. And that's why you'll see in medications, it says, as was said by another one of the honorable members, that if you're taking large amounts of certain medication, they'll actually advise you not to use machinery or drive. The next point, you were right, and I actually did cover this. There are no magic bullets, and we need enforcement, and we need the equipment, but that shouldn't be the reason not to have the right legislation. That's a separate issue, getting the police trained, motivated, and having the right properly calibrated equipment. I think we can have both. Thank you.
Thank you. Any take from Pats?
Thanks, Chen. I think also, if I saw the chat, Honorable Matevule from the EFF also had some questions. I think, just to welcome the question members again. I think Honorable Broadseth, I apologize, I'm sure I'm butchering the surname, is right. It's about, we need to also, we pass progressive laws, but then we fail collectively as a nation to make sure relevant officials or the public at large, et cetera, businesses, whomever, are aware of their rights, their responsibilities, their obligations. We under-resource many of the public services. I think we can see, Chairperson, that municipalities are in serious trouble right now. 90% of them are financially struggling. Leave aside the 27 who simply don't have money to pay the staff. But Chair, we saw with the South African Revenue Service, when the state invested in it, gave it additional allocations to hire additional staff to invest in the IT capacity and so forth. But there was a positive yield to an additional 94 billion rand. So similarly, our point is, Chair, if we invest in municipal traffic enforcement, yes, there'll be an immediate cost to the fiscal, but there'll be a positive recovering of that money because you'll have lower accident rates, which means less money claimed from the road accident fund. There'll be less loss of income to those families who have lost breadwinners. There'll be less disruption to the economy, which might lose employees, etc. So yes, there's an immediate cost, but the amount of money you recover afterwards from savings will be far greater. If you look at the cost in terms of road accidents, the abuse of alcohol is far greater than the amount of money it would cost to simply hire an additional few police officers in KZN or any other province, etc. Chair, I think also the issue of enforcement, there was a fatal traffic accident in Mitch's plane on, I think, is it yesterday or the day before, five learners who were being transported at the back of a bucky. They died, so five children died. There is an existing law which says we can't transport people at the back of a bucky, whether it's farm workers or learners, etc. But again, it comes to the same point about enforcement. If we don't make sure we enforce, have sufficient traffic officers on the road, then people will not be aware of the law and will ignore it. Chair, on the issue of truck drivers, the Basic Conditional Employment Act covers overtime and the limits to overtime, but those are routinely abused by trucking companies. So there is a need through the BSA regulations, but also through the Department of Transport regulations too, to govern and provide a more safe approach to truck drivers, because they really are under huge pressure by the companies, by the retailers to transport the goods to arrive at this point, and hence you see a significant amount of speeding, etc. And I think Honorable Dung was right. We've seen a significant amount of abuse of blue lights, be it by public or private vehicles, and that really needs to be tackled. Chair, I think just to Honorable Matavula's question, the emergency vehicles and VIP officers, right now in the bill's provisions, it's a bit too broad. It just says emergency vehicles. And I think we've all seen, Chair, with the examples that I made of comrade, the late comrade Collins Chabane and other comrades who passed away tragically, is that this is being abused in many instances, and there's a real human consequence to it. So we think, Chair, in the bill's provisions on emergency vehicles, we should simply have a subclause which exempts VIP protectors from using that in the instance of non-emergencies. But yeah, I think that's covered all the points, Chairperson. Thanks very much to members.
Thank you, Matthew. I guess these three hands are legacy hands.
Chair, my hand as well, please.
Oh, okay. Over to you, Honorable Boshoff.
Thank you very much. Listening to Mr. Parks, I just want to say we cannot lay the blame at the door of trucking companies only. I come from Mpumalanga, where we are inundated on our roads with heavy vehicles transporting chrome and platinum and coal, et cetera, et cetera. Many of our drivers cannot stop along the road, because as soon as they stop to take a rest, they are attacked, their tires are stolen off, their products are stolen off. So we need to have a look at something to try and protect the product and the driver. So there should be things like extra stopping areas along these roads to assist our drivers, because many of the drivers that transport the chrome and the platinum from the mines are traveling down to Mozambique, and the N4 is one of the most dangerous roads when it comes to pulling off and stopping to take a break. So if we could just have a look at that, and then just note that it is not just the trucking companies that are forcing their drivers, but the environment that does not allow the driver to stop. Thank you.
Thank you, General Boshoff.
No, thanks, Chair. Honorable Boshoff is correct. In fact, one of the major factors if we want to assist in that crisis, especially from Mpumalanga, is to fix Transnet. Many companies, like mining companies, which used to transport the heavy products on rail, no longer do so because of the cable theft, which is crippling Transnet. And of course, many companies also are shifting from sending their products to Durban or Cape Town or other local ports, instead of going to Maputo, etc., because of the port congestion. So we need to fix transit both on the freight rail and also fix Transit Ports Authority. Because that is now having a spillover effect to the roads in Mpumalanga. And of course, Chair Boshoff is 100% right. And there's also a cost to the roads. Roads are prematurely deteriorating at a very dangerous rate, and a danger to commuters because of the excessive amount of heavy trucks. So we need to fix those issues. And Chair, really is a worrying thing. The explosion of cable theft, the criminal destruction of Transnet, Metro Rail, and so forth. I mean, it is positive that government has put in place a scrap metal export ban as a temporary measure to try to deal with the criminal syndicates and to find a way to regulate the sector, the legitimate sector. But it also means we have to make sure we have police being deployed with the support of intelligence, defense force, and even private security to try to secure a railway infrastructure network. It does mean we must give support to the NPA and to the court so they have sufficient resources to tackle these criminal syndicates. And often they are very sophisticated criminal syndicates, as Honorable Boshoff is raising. And these are not easy things, but Chair, if we continue to take a soft approach as a society, as government, then we really are going to allow a kind of Wild West situation to destroy South Africa's economy. And it's getting to a tipping point, and we think, Chair, we really need to take off the gloves when it comes to these criminal syndicates who are a threat to companies, to workers, to society, to the state. And it's getting really out of control, Chairperson. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you for the response. Then allow me to take this opportunity to express a word of gratitude to both Professor Perry and Mr. Matthew Parks for the extensive manner in which they were able to take us through the presentations, and also responding to the clarity-seeking questions that were posed by honorable members as part and parcel of the engagement. We really appreciate your presence. I think we will then move forward in terms of the program. I know that the next will be the presentation from the Parliament, Mrs. P. Ngema, Prof. And Matthew. Are comfortable, they can continue to be with us. Other than that, where they have the view that they can excuse us, I think we will appreciate that. But the meeting continues, so your continued presence is also appreciated. Let's then give over to Mrs. P. Ngema to give us a presentation on the limitation on the consideration of public submission, because now we're moving to another bill, which is the National Land Transport Amendment Bill, number B7F of 2016. Over to you, Mrs. P. Ngema.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I trust I am audible, and apologize for the background noise, which I think is coming on the neighbors dealing with their grass cutting. I greet all the members and yourself, Chairperson, and thank you for the opportunity together with the staff and everyone that is on the platform. Chairperson, I appreciate my slot, and maybe just to go back on the bill that we've just stepped down from, the one question that I think maybe was missed.
We can't see you, Ms. Ngema.
Okay, Chairperson.
There you are. Then you can produce. I think it's always important that the public is able to associate the voice with the face.
I apologize, Chairperson. I think the issue is this lack of strength with our bandwidth. So I didn't realize that I didn't even put myself on. Chairperson, I think I wanted to first, before I get to the National Land Transport limitation issues as a remitted bill, I just wanted to point out in respect of the National Land Traffic, Road Traffic Amendment Bill and their submissions that I quickly went to check on the explanatory memorandum of the bill so that maybe we could find the answer to the question about whether NetLeg was consulted. Unfortunately, it doesn't deal with that, but perhaps maybe that department might share the light if they are present on that, whether the consultation with NEDLAC was done in respect of that bill. In respect of the task that I'm giving, Chairperson, I think, as I pointed out during the briefing discussions, when the matter was brought before the committee, the Section 79 remitted bill arises when the president has sent back a bill that Parliament has processed through both houses. So the restrictions that comes, they are coming from the joint rules of Parliament, which is enabled by the Constitution to actually make rules and regulations as to how it runs their processes. So in terms of joint rules, Chairperson, it is actually stipulated that when the two houses deal with the remitted bill, it is supposed to only deal with the reservations and restrict themselves to the reservations that the president has raised. That may raise that may become a very difficult task when the question is related to substance and content of a bill, because the president may raise an issue or reservations with a single provision, but if there are spill-ons or knock-on effects to the other provisions, then it becomes a most difficult exercise to do. And I think the submissions that are speaking to that issue are trying to point out that specific issue. That said, Chairperson, I do appreciate and understand that the rules were made in order to ensure that we do not then have to get a second bite on touching on issues that have already been canvassed by trying to push in things when a bill is remitted. So the restrictions and the limitations that the committee is facing are valid in a sense that the Constitution has enabled Parliament to establish rules that are regulating in the manner that is already been done. And that is why in this instance, Chairperson, there are those reservations and restrictions in how proceeding with this question of a remitted bill and the issues raised, how it can be done. So I believe my caution will be on saying, when the committee considers whatever is being raised right now, we can perhaps look at the issue as to how far are the spill-ons and how intricated and involved is the other provisions, which the president might not have directly spoken to, but are the issues that are raised. And for example, Chairperson, I think one issue is that one related to the interventions by the minister. And if one, as they are going to be indicating when they do their own presentation, I believe, if one looks at Section 139 and the manner that the intervention is now stipulated on the bill, the question, Chairperson, is that it seems through this legislation, once it's gone through the stage of being a bill, we are then going to empower the minister with a power that is contrasting what the Constitution is providing, because the intervention in the manner that the bill is doing is giving the power to the national government, whereas the intervention must first follow the way that the powers are devolved. It must first allow the provincial government to intervene. And once then, maybe there are failures there, as we see in Section 154 of the Constitution, the national government can also intervene. So there is a distinction with the manner and the process that the interventions must be handled. So that restriction, Chairperson, would require the committee to apply itself to those issues and see whether the restrictions and the limitations that are presented by the issues raised cannot be addressed in some way or another, Chairperson. I think that would be the advice, and for now, the input that I provide without taking too much into the content and the substance of the issues that are raised, because the committee is still going to do their own clause-by-clause deliberations and direct us how to go about. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Sundema, for the word of caution that you have given to us as a committee. We will then, I see there's a message there. You can just see whether this message, does it apply to what you have said? Okay, I guess it relates to the previous, but I suspect it's a question for the department. Let's just note it. We'll deal with it after. Can we then move over to the overview by Dr. Clark? Dr. Clark, on the written submissions on the bill.
Yes, Chairperson, thank you. Okay. Just get to the okay. Okay, so the National Land Transport Amendment Bill. The Department of Transport. The Department of Transport briefed the committee on the clauses in respect of which the president had reservations, and that meeting, Chairperson, took place on 15 March 2023. On 26th of March, an advertisement was placed, Chairperson, in national media calling for written submissions on the bill. In that call for submissions, Chair, stakeholders were informed that in terms of joint rule 209 of Parliament, comments are to be limited to amendments which address reservations previously expressed by the President, acting in terms of Section 79 of the Constitution. The committee will hear oral submissions on the bill today, Chairperson, and the department will be in front of the committee on the 14th of June 2023 to provide its submissions, to provide its response to submissions on the bill, Chairperson. I'm grateful for Ms. Ngema, Chair, who provided the introduction to how the department would then go about responding to the written and the oral submissions, Chair. So ordinarily, you would have your inputs and the department would come to provide the response on the inputs. What we essentially now, Chair, is we have to add in one step. This is the input. And then there will have to be a consideration on the extent to which the inputs are related to the reservations that has been expressed by the department, by the president. And so that process will happen on the 14th of June 2023. So the broad objects of the bill, Chairperson and committee members, is to amend the National Land Transport Act to insert certain divisions to provide for non-motorized and accessible transport, to bring the act up to date with the development since implementation of the act, to provide for certain powers of provinces to conclude contracts for public transport services, to expand the powers of the minister to make regulations and introduce safety measures, to amend other transport-related legislation, and to bring it in line with the act, and to clarify or simplify various provisions or solve problems that have arisen since the implementation of the act to provide for matters connected therewith. So that's the broad objects of the bill, Chairperson. However, the reservations that the president has expressed were raised on the unconstitutionality of certain provisions of the bill, which, for example, allowed provinces to conclude new contracts and at the same time to allow national government to intervene where provinces and municipalities failed to perform this duty. So inputs were received, Chairperson, by the South African Local Government Association, which is with us today to deliver their oral submissions, the City of Cape Town, the South African Bus Operators Association, and the Western Cape Government Department of Mobility. So there is some support for the bill, Chairperson, specifically the broad intention of the bill. BALT, for example, supports the enabling provisions for different modes of land transport, such as e-hailing, that the bill will now provide for, as it will provide greater equity and enforcement mechanisms for supporting road safety and reasonable road use. They are of the view that it is constructive in providing effective, sustainable, and pragmatic interventions as part of collective measures implemented to support an effective regulatory regime for land transport modes, including e-hailing services, which benefit commuters. Like some of the other institutions making submission free. There is concern about the delay in finalizing the bill, specifically that the absence of finalizing the bill as well as implementation means that land-based transport, including e-hailing, will continue to operate in a legislative and regulatory state of flux and uncertainty. Those providing submissions on the bill, Chairperson, they acknowledge that the current version of the bill addresses, to a large extent, the reservations that is raised by the President in respect of Clause 7 of the bill. There is, however, proviso, Chairperson, that you will hear from Salga, that's echoed in the view of City of Cape Town, however, that there are other provisions of the Principal Act and the bill that remain unconstitutional. For example, Chairperson, there's a view that 11.1b of the bill provides for the responsibilities of the provincial sphere of government, and that it should be specified that the provincial sphere of government is able to plan, implement, and manage provincial land transport initiatives, including public transport services. This is not necessarily the issues on the unconstitutionality, Chairperson and members, but this is some of the inputs received arguing for attention that attention should be given to these matters. It's also viewed that the province should be able to enter into public transport contracts in specific circumstances where requested to do so by a municipality and subject to Section 12.1 agreement, as is not currently clear, municipalities will negotiate and conclude contracts where the operators for services provide these services within a province, but across municipalities. So this is the aspects, Chair, that relate to possible areas of unconstitutionality, at least on the part of those delivering doing the submissions. The first one is that requiring agreement from PRASA or other rail providers in relation to the provision of service level planning for passenger rail on a corridor network basis would delay or hinder the completion of the relevant integrated transport plan if such agreement is not forthcoming or delayed. So it's submitted that consultation is a lesser or more realistic standard to achieve. There's also a reference made to an earlier version of the bill, Chairperson, which empowered the minister to prescribe requirements and criteria with which municipalities must comply in order to conclude contracts. This was deleted after the president raised concerns about the constitutionality thereof, in that national and provincial governments are not generally permitted through legislation to assume local government functions for themselves. In a similar vein, it's submitted that the proposed 11.10a inserted by clause 7g should be deleted. Not only does it encroach on the functions of the municipality, but the deletion thereof will enable municipalities to manage the negotiation and tendering for contracts in a manner that considers the specific circumstances of the matter and that will be advantageous to them. There's also a view that in respect of contracted and subsidized commuter bus services, which may be considered to be dominant and exceed the 70% threshold for dominance defined in the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill, there appears to be significant overlap between the functions contemplated in the regulation of regulated entities as defined in the Economic Regulation and Transport Bill and the National Land Transport Amendment Bill. The prescribed reporting lines and the responsibilities in the model tender documents as well as in this amendment bill. This is cause for concern as it would place an unnecessary burden on operators to report and account to various entities on the exact same manner, with the risk that what one entity may accept as regular basis, another as a regular business, another entity may consider it in a totally different manner. So next week we will deal with economic regulation of transport bill. So I spoke about the proviso that those providing submissions say that the provisions were generally addressed, but there is other areas of the bill. Ms. Ngema might have spoken about as the spill-ons, Chairperson, or the knock-ons that actually have remained alive through in the bill or in the principal act. The general concern with the act, which is carried over into the bill, is that there is an assumption that national government can be more interventionist than the constitution allows. For example, Section 5.6 of the Regional Act provides for intervention by the minister responsible for transport into the affairs of a province or municipality that cannot or does not fulfill an executive obligation in terms of the matters relating to public transport. So this last slide is a summary of the areas that have been highlighted as possibly remaining unconstitutional within the legislative framework as it stands at the moment. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Doc, for taking us through the written submissions. We will then, without any waste of time, take the oral presentation from SALGA, Mr. Onyinsi. If there are any clarification questions that members would want to make in relation to the two previous speakers, they can just note them, and then after SALGA, we'll then allow members to engage with the presentations. Over to you, Mr. Mtoninsi. Yes, SALGA.
Good morning, Chairperson.
Morning.
Siana Mkhahle. I'm joining on a gadget labeled Bakwena Mkhahle.
Okay.
My camera is giving me a difficulty, Chair, and in fact, I am going to hand over to Mr. Mtoninsi, maybe just as an introduction, Chairperson, if you allow me with that technology hiccup.
That's no problem.
Great. Thank you very much, Chairperson. My name is Siana Mkhahle, Acting Chief Officer for Infrastructure, Roads and Transport Cluster. Chairperson, we have prepared this oral submission, which my colleague, Mr. Mtoninsi, is going to take us through. He is the senior manager responsible for roads and transport. Chair, it has a background that we have engaged with the matter for a while, including having made a submission to the president, raising the concerns. We note that there is alignment with the previous two speakers that have spoken on the matter, relating to the fact that while there has been some amendments that have been made to the original bill, there is still a residual concerns, which my colleague, Mr. Mtoninsi, will speak to. Can I hand over to him? If you could flash your presentation, Mr. Mtoninsi, and then take the committee through. Thank you very much, and thank you for your indulgence, Chairperson.
My pleasure.
Good morning, Chair. I'm an honourable members of the Standing Ombudsman Committee. I'm going to try, Chair, to see if I can share my presentation. I hope it's visible, Chair.
It is, Mr. Mtoninsi. You can continue.
Oh, thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate and note the two presentations before me, the presentation by Ms. Ngema and the presentation by Dr. Clark. And I think, Chair, maybe as a preamble to this presentation is to accept what Ms. Ngema is saying, and note that in SALGA, our issues with the bill go beyond the issues of constitutionality, and then leave it to the committee to decide which of these submissions are applicable based on the advice that Ms. Ngema is saying. And then allow our presentation to focus largely on the constitutional issues, Chair. Also importantly, Chair, so that we don't belabor the point, is not to really emphasize the issue of consultation around the bill, but rather seek to focus on the key issue around the constitutionality of the bill. Before we engage on Section 5, Subsection 6 of the Act, which is a spill-on and based on Ms. Ngema's advice, let's deal with the relationship between Section 154 of the Constitution and Section 139 of the Constitution. Our view, Chair, is that the idea of intervention as envisaged in Section 139 is different from the assistance and the capacitation of municipalities as based in Section 154. Included in that view is to say, in an instance where municipalities are unable to perform their functions, rather than include Section 139, or rather than invoke Section 139, the responsibility of both national government and provincial government is to assist municipalities first before intervening, because the nature of intervening includes suspension and a whole lot of other things, as it does with Section 100 on provinces. So the first issue is, should the amendment of the bill, or rather the amendment of the Act, should allow for assistance first before there is intervention? Indeed, I think Section 11 of the Act that gives responsibility to both this institution as per Section 154 of the Constitution. However, what the Act or the bill doesn't do is to create a chronological order between the applications of these two provisions of the Constitution. And our submission is that there should be assistance first and then intervention. And if to use the right clauses, it should be an invocation of Section 154 before there's an invocation of 139. Then, Chair, go to the next important point. The next important point is that Section 7 of the bill, indeed, we accept, Chair, that it was removed. However, this removal of Section 7 of the bill is now made, in our view, of no effect, because, as I think in the submissions that the Portfolio Committee had made, the minister can still do the same things that the minister was allowed to do Section 7 through a different section of the Act, which is Section 5, Subsection 6. And if we take Section 5, Subsection 6 and impose Section 139 of the Constitution on that provision, the provision on Section 139 does not include any national minister, certainly in the sense of transport, being able to intervene directly in a municipal council. Typically, in a practical sense, being that the minister will instruct a municipal council on what to do. That provision in Section 139 only includes a provincial executive, doesn't include a national minister. Our understanding is that the only national minister that is allowed to intervene based on Section 139 is the minister responsible for managing the finances of the Republic. No other minister has made provisions for in that Section 139. So certainly our view is that the spirit of the letter of the president, because we our view of that of the spirit of the letter of the president is that is in two parts. One, there's the spirit of the letter, and then number two, there's the actual specific clauses that the letter refers to. So certainly we believe that the spirit of the letter is not adhered to if Section 5, Subsection 6 of the Act is not amended, because it means whatever the minister is now unable to do through the deleted Section 7 is now able to do through this provision. So in other words, whatever the president was trying to cure will not be cured, or what is proposed there is not a complete solution to what the president had raised as concern. And therefore, Chair, our view, and without going to every little point, Chair, on this submission and this presentation, is that that section must then be amended as part of this bill, so that the effect of what the president had sought to alert the parliament on is then given effect. And if that section is not amended, then all the president had asked to do would not be achieved. And then the other issue around issues of constitutionality, Chair, that would like to raise is the issue of Section 5, Subsection 4 of the same Act. That provision uses quite an important language because it says the minister must ensure that there's integration of public transport. However, in the Constitution and the division of the functions in the Constitution based on the schedules of the Constitution, municipal public transport is an exclusive function of municipalities. So our view is that the minister can therefore not ensure over functions that do not fall under the jurisdiction of the minister. In other parts of both the Act and the Bill, there's a much more softer language that is being used. And that language would be to encourage, and which we believe is far more appropriate language in the sense, especially when it includes functions that are of an exclusive nature to other spheres of government. Certainly, we do accept and we do support the issue of integration. It's the idea that the minister must ensure. And certainly, our belief is that that can only be possible if the Section 5, Subsection 6 of the Act remains. Because through an instruction or through an intervention can a minister be able to ensure. Without that, the minister cannot be able to ensure. So part of our submission then, Honorable Chair, is that even that part of the Act must be amended to ensure that the language that is being used befits the nature of the distribution of the functions between the three spheres of government. But the minister is not allowed to ensure over exclusive functions of another sphere of government. So, Chair, I think in totality, that is the submission, Chair, without really taking the committee to every line or every dot or bullet point of the presentation. But I think that's the submission. Just to recapture so that before I complete, is our issues with the bill go beyond the constitutional issues. Hence, our submission is a long submission. However, we note the issue that Ms. Ngema raised in sense that the bill having been remitted is not an opportunity to reopen all the issues around the bill. We note that based on joint rules, and we would like to respect those rules. But at the same time, Chair, that's a decision the committee will have to make. But secondly, then, these are the constitutional issues. And sadly, on the constitutional issues, we do believe that these issues are in the spirit of the letter of the president, and these are spill-ons that come from the spirit of the letter and the clauses of the letter that the president had written. And certainly the exclusion of Section 7 of the bill only is not enough to effect what the president had brought to the attention of Parliament regarding the bill. On that regard, thank you very much, Chair, to you and to your honourable members. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Ntominsi from SALDA for raising those two areas. What I'll then do, I'll then again invite members of the committee for clarity-seeking questions in relation to the presentation that we have received. Over to you, members. It looks like members are quite. Let me just check on the chat group. Right. This relates to the previous presentation. Maybe just from my side. Can you just go back to that? Section to that, the last part of the presentation that speaks to the when is the intervention possible? I think the sentence starts with the municipal public transport is an exclusive function of a municipality and only possible if the yes. I think one of the things that I just want to get clarity on Mr. Tonintsi is the intervention. The language, the question of language that you have referred to, section 5.4. Your take is that this section 5.4, to a larger degree, dilute the removal of section 5.4, section 7, because in terms of section 7, though it was removed, but through the back door, section 5.4 still makes provision for what has been removed because of the constitutionality thereof, because in terms of the municipal function, the transport, municipal transport is a domain of the municipality in terms of the constitution. Is that what we are saying?
Yeah, sorry, just a correction, Chair, in response to your question, and thank you for the question. It's section 5.6, subsection 6, Chair, not section 5, subsection 4, that we believe in relation to the exclusivity of the function as well. So the one you're referring to is section 5, subsection 6. Section 5, subsection 4 relates to the language where it says that the minister must ensure, and we are saying municipal public transport is an exclusive function. The minister does not have any powers over that municipal public transport because it's an exclusive function. So the minister cannot ensure over something that does not belong or that he or she has no responsibility over. And that is our submission. That is an addition, Chair. Note that section 11, 8, 9, and 10 of the bill are premised on section 5, subsection 6. In other words, they are only possible through section 5, subsection 6. And that, Chair, to use your language, is the backdoor that we are speaking about, or rather what nullifies the effect of the exclusion of the old section 7 of the bill, because on the one side, that is taken out, but the same thing is possible through another section of the act, and that section is section 5, subsection 6, Chair. So that is our submission, Chair, that in essence, then, this leads to no change at all.
Okay. I get you now, Mr. Tonintsi. Honorable Khai?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Let me point out at the onset that due to ill health, I was not part of the presentation on all these bills, including the previous one. So I also unfortunately didn't have an opportunity to go through the presentation that I did not have an opportunity. Maybe something that I must set time aside to familiarize myself with all the bills that have been dealt with during my absence. I just wanted clarity on the point that was raised by Ms. Pumelel on terms of the implication of the remitted bill to other sections within the body of the bill. If she can make example, which are those provisions she's referring to. The second point to Salga is on this issue of section 5.6. For me, as the committee, we are dealing with the bill, amendment bill that is before us, not the principal act. So if you can clarify for me, because the section 5, subsection 6, according to my understanding, has always been there in the Principal Act, which we are not dealing with. We're dealing with the bill that for us. So I don't think it will be correct, therefore, to amend what is not before us. We amend what is before us, what is in the bill, not what is not being amended as a proposed amendment in the Principal Act. I just need the clarity on those 2 points, Chair. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Honorable Khai. Ms. Ngema?
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I think the example, the simple and straightforward one is exactly the one that both myself and the presenter from SALGA has spoken to, the one about 5-6 and the impact of 7 as the reservations of the president were speaking to 7. That is the most glaring one we were speaking to and what we are bringing before the committee. But other ones, Chairperson, because the bill was not previously mine as well, I have not done the exercise of unpacking all of the provisions that may have been so impacted. But as I said, what is explained in respect of what is going to be the final impact and when the implementation happens by what 5-6 provide is exactly what sort of Clause 7 was implying to achieve as well, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. Salga, Mr. Mtonintsi.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to try and use an example to make a point. Firstly, Chair, the principle is that we believe that Section 5-6, even if it's part of the Act, is a natural, unavoidable, inevitable spill on from what the instructions of the president were, or the concerns of the president were. The concerns of the president related to the constitutionality of the interventions of the minister, partly. And we believe, and certainly in the if one gets into the, there are two, at least two sources. One is the minutes of the portfolio committee on transport relating to the removal of Section 7. It states there clearly that there's an acceptance of removal of Section 7, but then the minister can still do the same interventions through Section 5-6 of the Act. So in our view, it makes the whole removal of Section 7 of no use if Section 5-6 can still allow the minister to do exactly what Section 7 was removed. So it's a natural spill-on in our view. A simple example would be if, for example, the president had concerns about us, SALGA, traveling to Johannesburg. It's fine, Mr. President, we will not travel by plane, but we will travel by bus. So in fact, Section 7 is the plane of the bill, and then Section 5-6 is by bus, or based on the Act. So our view is the issue is whether you should travel or not how you travel. So the issue here is exactly that in the end, the undesirable provision and possible action by the minister would still be possible through the Act, even if they are not possible through the bill. So our concern is whatever the concerns of the president were for all practical purposes are not addressed by simply removing Section 7 of the bill. They can only be completely addressed by making amendments to Section 5, subsection 6 of the Act, even if that section was not part of the original bill. But we believe that the concern remains, and hence we made the earlier point when we were addressing the committee to say there's the spirit of the letter of the president, and then there's the specific clauses the president referred to. So Section 5-6 might not have been part of the specific clauses, but it's a natural spin-off based on the constitutionality. And really, the letter from the president is about constitutionality. And Section 5, subsection 6 in our submission is unconstitutional and would make would make a leeway that is unconstitutional for the minister to intervene. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Doninsi, for that response. Yes, Honorable Khai.
Chair, my fear is that our responsibility is to look at the remitted bill, the reservations of the president, not to overstep our mandate of going back to the principal act and check what are the other clauses in the principal act that we believe that they are unconstitutional. That's not our role. Our role is to deal with the reservations of the president. It ends there. Now, if any party or with regard to the stakeholders have any issues with the principal act, the parties are free to deal with that, with the provision in the principal act that are not part of the amended bill, to the constitutional court, to a court, let me put it that way. If I can make an example with the copyright amendment bill, the Blind SA pick up that the current act on the copyright bill, act, as provisions that are unconstitutional. It went to court, and then the court ruled in their favor. And then we had to correct that based on the instruction of the court. We are busy correcting that as we speak in the copyright amendment bill as an instruction of court. Now, with this one, we don't have any instruction from the court that we must amend section 5, subsection 6 of the Principal Act, nor that provision is part of the amendment bill that is before us. We may want to agree with the SALGA, for example, to amend section 5, subsection 6. But it's not part of the bill that is before us. It's something that is in the Principal Act. We can't just go to the Principal Act and just amend whatever we don't like that is in the Principal Act. And that is not our duty. Our duty is to deal with the bill that is before us. And the bill that is before us, in my thinking, doesn't have a section 5, subsection 6. That is my understanding. But I'm subject to correction, because as I was indicating, Chair, that I was not part of the briefing. I have not had the opportunity to look at the proposed bill itself, whether it contains a section 5, a subsection 6. Maybe that's where Ms. Gemma can clearly clarify for us whether the bill also includes, the remitted bill includes section 5, subsection 6. I understand the fact that all these other clauses that have been deleted, it would be a wish, therefore, that for example, if there was no amended bill before us, it means that the principal act would be still applying, in my understanding, if there was no amendment at all. That section 5, subsection 6 would still be applying if there was no amended bill before us. So what would then SALGA do in that case? In that case, it would have to go to the Constitutional Court on the unconstitutionality of that section, because there would be no bill before Parliament to address that specific issue that they're complaining about. But again, I want to emphasize that I'm speaking under correction here. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Khai. I wanted to bring the attention of the members that the 14th of June, we'll be getting the department's response in relation to both oral and written submissions, but also Ms. Ngema did indicate that her brief was restricted to what was before her, and therefore probably she will also get an opportunity then to look into the other issues that that Sandra raised that were not canvassed, because right at the beginning, Mr. Antonins indicated that there are two issues that he's raising. The first one relates to the constitutionality, and then the second one relates to the spillover, which obviously addresses the issues that Honorable Khai is raising. But I wanted to allay the fears of honorable members that we still have an opportunity on the 14th of June to engage, having had an opportunity to get the response from the department, and also our parliamentary legal services will be able to help us. Let me give over to Honorable Tim, and then let Salga then leave the matter there. Thank you. Honorable
Bratise? Thank you, Chairperson. I agree, Honorable Khai. I think we are talking about the Principal Act. And also, just my question to the representatives from CEO is, do they not feel that sufficient protection exists in Section 139, which specifically says that only provinces can intervene and specifically excludes the minister? So that's my opinion, but I do agree with Honorable Khai that we shouldn't be looking at the Principal Act, only the Act before, only the amendment before us. But as you say, Chairperson, if you don't want to belabor the matter, that's fine, we can deal with it on the 14th of June. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Those, it was a bit of a struggle to hear you. Let's just give a last point to Salga. Just as I indicated, today we are receiving submissions. We'll get the response. We'll get the department responding on the 14th of June. Any last point that you want to raise, Mr. Toninsi?
Chair, yeah, thank you so much. We note the comments made by Honorable Khai. And Chair, maybe it boils down to interpretation of the joint rules of the House. And maybe, Chair, if we could then be given an opportunity to make a submission to the committee regarding our interpretation of those rules, because I think that's what it boils down to. And I do understand that Honorable Khai was presenting a view on the provisions of those rules. And I think Ms. Ngema was also speaking about the same thing. So I think, Chair, what would help is just we kind of request an opportunity to make a submission about our interpretation of those rules. And then secondly, to respond to the Honorable Tim's point, yes, Chair?
Now you can continue.
Oh, okay, thank you. I was saying our view is that there mustn't be a conflict, and I think that's what the Constitution provides, between legislation and the Constitution. So we wouldn't want to have protection from the Constitution, but be vulnerable on the legislation, whereas our idea is that the two should be aligned. So our reliance is not only, for argument purposes, yes, we're relying on the Constitution, but we would like the legislation to be aligned with the Constitution. If it's not, then we are forced to go to court every time something like that happens to argue about the Constitution, because the legislation is leaving us as municipalities vulnerable. So that's the reason why we don't think that having this in Section 139 only and leave this provision in the Act is sufficient. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Toninsi. I think the honourable members, we have now reached the end of this discussion, and then allow the department on the 14th of June to respond. But also, I think our team will also have an opportunity to process the issues that were canvassed, and then the 14th of June we'll get an opportunity to hear the department side. And on that note, let me then express a word of gratitude to all our our guest, Salda in particular, for the her presentation, and allow us then to do our own in-house matters, noting that we are again meeting on the 14th of June to receive the department. I saw Tandy was part and parcel of the meeting, and I suspect also there were other members from the department that were part and parcel of us. Let me then go back to the minutes of the, just trying to check my program here. The minutes, of the meeting of last week, of the 24th of May. Let's deal with the minutes of the 24th of May. That's the attendees. Can you move up? Those are the members that were present. And the apologies noted. Processing our reports of the departments of the APPs and budgets. That is the parliamentary staff. Like as indicated, it was the consideration and adoption of budget vote reports. We dealt with the vote 40, transport, public works and infrastructure, planning, monitoring and evaluation, public service and administration, National School of Government, and public service commission. And the reports, as indicated, that's how the vote went. We had the reports adopted by the committee with the reservation from the Democratic Alliance and also with the objection from the EFF side, and the ANC supporting the adoption of the reports. And because we had more, we had six provinces supporting the adoption, the reports were duly adopted. Then we then dealt with the minutes of the 10th of May, 2023, which were duly adopted. That is how it was moved and seconded to. Any correction that members would want to make in relation to the minutes? In the absence of that, can we then get a move for the adoption of the minutes of the 24th of May as a true reflection of what transpired?
I'll move, Chair.
Team moves. Can you get a seconder?
Thank you very much. Good morning, Honorable Chairperson. I move for the second. I second the adoption of the minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think I saw the apology of Honorable Protestant in the minutes.
Yes, she was busy with the election campaign.
So I would like to second Honorable Musodi.
Thank you. Honorable Kai. Noted, team, you forgot to remind us that you walloped us yesterday in the plenary. Thank you, team. Let's just check now I suspect Doc would just want to give us an update in terms of the trip. And Grace, let's allow both of them to give us an indication as to how the process is moving.
Thank you, Chairperson. The application was submitted to the Office of the House Chair on Monday, after we received the programs and the quotations from the travel agent. Just this morning, I received an email from the office of the house chair to say I must just make amendments on the application in terms of the figures and in terms of the number of staff members that are traveling. Instead of 5 members, they said we must put like 2 staff members on the application. Okay. But the members will remain the same.
Okay.
The application. We have 8 members that are going with a trip.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you for that update. Any reflection?
Another thing, Chair. I'm sorry.
Yes.
We would like to request that members send the copy of their official passports to Enrico as from today, please.
Thank you, Mrs. Grace, for that update. Just want to check whether members any clarity in question.
Okay. Yeah, Chair. Mrs. Grace is indicating the House Chairperson when we're at the plenary outside. He approached me and complaining about the amount as well as the number of staff that will be part of the trip. He said he was ready to sign, but subject to us reducing the number of staff. And we asked how many staff members. Initially, he wanted 1 staff member, but put some pressure that there were 2 committees, at least if there could be 1 staff member from each of the 2 committees. Then he agreed to that. So, and then we had a discussion as board chairs. We agreed that we'll take 1 staff member from the Committee on Trade and 1 staff member from the Committee on Transport and Public Works. So we agree on 1 committee secretary from the Select Committee on Trade and a content advisor from Transport and Public Service and Administration Select Committee. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Fai, for that update. I guess members now must just prepare themselves now. That's finally around.
Chairperson.
Yes, Mushori.
Chairperson.
Yes, Mushori.
I just want to clarify on the issue. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Mine is on the issue of a passport. I just want to check if Enrico is here in Parliament or was supposed to email the transport, the passport, or WhatsApp the passport to Enrico.
Yes, I think the first page of the picture of your first page of the passport. I think that's what he wanted.
Yes, you are
actually. Grace was saying that she's going to, send us another WhatsApp group just for the those that will be part of the group. I don't know why she's not saying it now, so that we send that will be using for communication about the trip and its logistics, including pictures of the first page of the passport. Sorry, Chair, I see the hand of Honorable Lunch.
Honorable Lunch?
Thank you, Chairperson. That letter that was sent to the House Chair for permission, can we please get a copy of that so that we can start the process of getting approval from our own parties to do that? Sometimes it might take long, so I don't want to leave it till the last minute. So if we can just get a copy of that letter, we can then use it in our own permission submissions to our own parties.
Okay.
Thank you a lot. Let's then see how we have members so that they can also get approval from their political parties. I guess honorable members, now we are done. Let's prepare ourselves for 2 o'clock as we are debating, and then let me take this opportunity to express a word of gratitude to all of you and also our guests, Salga, the parliamentary monitoring group, the department as a representative, honorable members and parliamentary staff. So therefore the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.